second and 10. And there's a handoff to Martin. Doug Martin, first down to the 15, and Martin is going to score. From the end zone, second and 10, and holding on to it is Vincent Jackson. One man coming after him. And it's Malcolm Jenkins, and Malcolm Jenkins gets to him.
Welcome into the Morning After Hill, a little bit of a more somber edition this week as the Buccaneers, of course, they do not win their matchup against the New Orleans Saints, but it was definitely a hotly contested matchup and one that the Buccaneers should not feel upset about losing. And we will address the controversial, and I am using air quotes, the controversial call at the end of the game that ended up going against the Buccaneers, I guess you can say. I don't want to say it ended up costing the Buccaneers the game, because as much as that call wasn't fun to hear and really deflating, the call itself was just deflating, and I think that's where a lot of the reaction is coming from, rightfully so. I mean, I got on all of you guys to be passionate last week, and that's exactly what I saw with the reaction to that call at the end of the game. But we'll get to that in just a second. Buccaneers, they win on Sunday, or excuse me, they lose on Sunday. Wish they would have won on Sunday. They lose on Sunday, 35-28 to the New Orleans Saints. Drew Brees goes off in the first half. It was a very explosive first half, actually. I mean, we had 28 points scored by the Saints and 21 scored by the Buccaneers. So, you know, lots and lots of offense going on here. And even though they lost the game, the Buccaneers, they were very much punch for punch in another shootout. We saw it week two against the New York Giants, and then we saw it again on Sunday yesterday against the New Orleans Saints. Just because this team goes to Dallas and only scores, you know, 10 or 13 points, or only scores 16 points against the Panthers, doesn't mean that if you put it in a situation where it's going to be a shootout, they're going to just disappear. We saw it against the Giants, and we saw it yesterday, against the New Orleans Saints, that this team, they want to win. And just because it's a shootout doesn't mean that they're going to lie down and it's going to be an easy win. Speaking of easy wins, the margin of error in the NFL is very, very, very slim. It appears from crunching the numbers that the margin of error is 5.5 for the Buccaneers, because that's the average points, or average total of points, that they've lost their four games this season. The loss against the Giants, the loss against the Cowboys, the loss against the Saints yesterday, and of course the loss against Robert Griffin III and the Redskins. But enough about that. Let's get into what this is all about, the good, the bad, and the ugly from a 35-28 loss to the New Orleans Saints.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
So obviously, getting into the good, that's going to be centered around Josh Freeman this week. Rightfully so, as well, because a career game, and we're not just saying that just to say it, literally a career game for Josh Freeman on Sunday against the New Orleans Saints, just went off on all of the critics, all the fans saying that he's part of the problem of why the Buccaneers were losing these past weeks. He answers all that with a 420-yard performance, 3 touchdowns. Biggest stat right here that everybody is overlooking, 0 interceptions on Sunday for Josh Freeman. And I think that that's a big stat that people are looking over, considering last season and considering so far this season. It was almost a guarantee that Josh Freeman was going to get an interception. In fact, it was an over-under discussion. Josh Freeman over or under 1 interception, and he's been flirting around 1 per game. He didn't get any on Sunday. He didn't throw any on Sunday. He probably should have had 1. You go back and look at the game film on the second drive for the Buccaneers, the one that ultimately ended in that Doug Martin touchdown. Earlier in the drive, Josh Freeman throws a ball that is, I don't want to say pretty clearly intercepted, but upon video replay, it did look like it was an interception. So the Buccaneers, they may have gotten bailed out of that one. So we'll use it as a ghost interception, if you will. But statistically speaking, Josh Freeman, 24-42, 420 yards, 3 touchdowns, and 0 interceptions. Quarterback rating is 72. We don't really pay much attention to quarterback ratings, because what matters is he brought the Buccaneers down within 5 yards of winning or tying the game, or potentially winning if you want to go for 2. But that's what matters in this. And this is the Josh Freeman of old that we saw on Sunday. The Josh Freeman, the 2010 Josh Freeman that leads the Buccaneers back from these deficits and these fourth quarter comebacks and all of this miraculous all of the miraculous things that we were expecting to see built upon in 2011 and instead were torn down. Now we're seeing that built upon in 2012, which is very, very encouraging for the future. Again, last week we talked about the future. The future is in the future. It's not now. The future's in the future for the Buccaneers. All of this has to come together down the road. And one of these things that has to come together is Josh Freeman. And on Sunday, he showed very much that he is in the process of coming, all of this coming together down the road in terms of his development. 420 yards, that in of itself speaks all on its own. People were saying Josh Freeman doesn't throw enough. People were saying Josh Freeman throws too much. I myself was saying Josh Freeman throws the deep ball too much. I guess we're just going to have to roll with this style of offense for now. It was a little bit more spread out on Sunday against the Saints. We did see another heavy dose of Doug Martin. And we did also see a heavy dose of the deep ball, particularly to Vincent Jackson, and particularly on the one play. But even that play, the 95-yard non-touchdown that ended in no points, of course, leave it to the Buccaneers to be the one team to throw the longest pass in like the last 30 years in the NFL and not get any points out of it. No Connor Barth field goal, no touchdown, just nothing. But, that is what it is. We're not going to discuss it because, it is what it is. Actually, we will discuss a bit of that, but right now that really doesn't have a lot to do with Josh Freeman, because that play, the 95-yard pass that went to Vincent Jackson, wasn't a deep pass. It was kind of a medium pass, in the gray area between medium pass and long pass. So, he's trying to throw the ball around. He had a 13-yard touchdown pass to Tyquan Underwood that, even if it was in the middle of the field, would have been a slot pass down the middle. So, he is trying to spread the ball around and not just rely on the deep ball. And, of course, the criticism of that last week was a worst-case scenario overreaction to the whole home run-style offense. And, obviously, it needs developing. And that's what we're seeing with the game on Sunday, where you've got to spread it around and you have to try to work it into the right situations. And I think he's starting to learn where this goes. Also, the Saints secondary isn't the greatest in the world. 420 yards doesn't happen against good defenses. It's not like Josh Freeman dissected the 1985 Chicago Bears and gashed them for 420 yards through the air. But he did manage to put up a career best, and there's really no taking that away from him. And it's definitely the golden good from Sunday. But there was a lot of goods, actually. You can't really just narrow it down to one and say this was the good, this was the bad, this was the ugly. It was kind of an eclectic, meshy mix of good, bad, and ugly. And, that's the NFL. The Buccaneers looked like an actual football team on Sunday, which, again, very encouraging for the future. Another good, which is an extension of the passing game, Josh Freeman's good, would be Vincent Jackson. Here's a guy that the Buccaneers bring in the offseason, give him a boatload of money to do exactly what he did on Sunday. Catch 7 passes from Josh Freeman and take him for 216 yards. Ridiculous performance by Vincent Jackson on Sunday. He does get into the end zone. Doesn't get into the end zone on the 95-yard catch, which was the longest on the day. But He does get in earlier on a play that, again, was questionable as to whether he actually got the ball into the end zone or whether his knee hit before. It was reviewed. It counted. We'll take it. That was his touchdown on the day. But 216 yards is just ridiculously disgusting in a good way. Awesome performance by Vincent Jackson on Sunday. And this is exactly why the Buccaneers brought him in. And again, building on this, this needs to be built on. A 216-yard performance, a 420-yard passing day from Josh Freeman. Don't forget about Doug Martin, 85 yards on the ground. He got the ball 16 times. Just a great day all around on offense for the Buccaneers. And it was reflected in the 28 points that they scored. Very well, it could have been 35 if Mike Williams doesn't get pushed out of the end zone and Josh Freeman doesn't happen to be out of the pocket when that happens. Then all of a sudden you've got Josh Freeman with a fourth touchdown. He's over 420 yards. And it's just a ridiculously good day all around because the Buccaneers have scored 35 points for the second time this season. So that's all could have, should have, would have. Stuff that we don't deal with because it didn't happen. A nice thought, but what did happen was 28 points. And you can never be upset when a team that struggled as mightily as it did last season looked as good as it did yesterday against still a very dangerous Saints team. I said it before the game, I said it during the game, and I'm continuing to say it. Don't count out the Saints when they have Drew Brees under center. Tampa, and I saw it happening too. I just saw it happening in my head. The Bucs jump out to a 14-0 lead, then it's 21-7, and everybody's all hopped and happy. Rightfully so. I mean, it's great. And it was very, very, very exciting to be up 21-7 on the New Orleans Saints. But don't forget who's calling the signals under center for the New Orleans Saints. He's a Hall of Famer. He's got just about every record within distance, the ones he hasn't broken. You know, everybody was talking a couple years ago about Brett Favre chasing Dan Marino on all these records. It's only a matter of time before Drew Brees is chasing Brett Favre down and he's breaking all these records. Don't count out Drew Brees. I don't think that people were, but I kind of felt it happening. There was this kind of blind excitement up 21-7. And you can be excited up 21-7, but don't be blindly excited when Drew Brees is the opposing quarterback because you saw what happens. He goes for 300 yards in the first half alone, 28 points. He did slow down in the second half, but there was such a violent shift going on in the analysis of the Bucs and how they were playing, both from writers and fans alike. And it was very interesting to see because you had the high hopes and then just this sudden drop-off where everything was going wrong and nothing was going right and all of a sudden we were back in these gloomy, dark days and these moody feelings. It was very interesting and it was also very fitting for a Buccaneers game. It was very fitting because it fits how this franchise has been the past couple years, where you'd really you're kind of on edge because you can be up 21-7, but you're going to give away that lead at some point. And some Bucs fans are conditioned that way, and I'm not talking just from these last couple years. I'm talking from years and years and years of being a Bucs fan where they're just conditioned to wait for it to stop being so good to be true, and then finally, you know, the catch comes in. The catch on Sunday was Drew Brees. Because he was in absolute top-notch form, which he usually is in. So, you know, don't be too upset that the Buccaneers blew that 21-7 lead. Because it's not like Brady Quinn came in and gashed him for 28 points in the first half. It's not like Blaine Gabbert came down from Jacksonville and gashed him for 28 points. Or, you know, Sage Rosenfels. Or some third-string quarterback from, you know, Oakland came in and gashed him for these points. It's Drew Brees came in and he got on fire. And to put this in a, you know, just kind of spin this in a way that maybe wouldn't be so negative, Drew Brees was firing a hot hand, and the Buccaneers stopped that dead cold in the second half. You look at Drew Brees' first half stats to his second half stats, entirely different. Okay, you've got 300 yards passing, he's got four touchdowns, he looks unstoppable. All of a sudden, it goes from the Bucs blowing out the Saints to the Saints are going to blow out the Bucs in this shootout. Second half, Drew Brees, I think he stays under 100 yards passing. Only gets into the end zone another time. And I believe that was on a handoff to Pierre Thomas. I don't think that was a touchdown pass. So Drew Brees was slowed way, way, way down in that second half. And so, that, you know, you don't want to look at that first half and say 28 points allowed is a positive, because in no universe is that a positive. But the second half was positive, because you go from 28 points allowed to 7 points allowed, and none of those were to Drew Brees. And you gave Drew Brees a lot of opportunities to cut that game wide open. And you didn't allow it to happen after 28 points allowed, 7 points allowed. So you got to compare and contrast these two. This isn't a completed team. Don't look at this like it's the Baltimore Ravens or the Houston Texans or the Green Bay Packers. And, you know, it's these ups and downs. It's going to be the ups and downs of a building team. It's not like there was some mechanical failure or technical play calling failure or somebody gave up on a play. The team's just not that good right now. It's a decent football team. They're not the worst team in the league. They're not the best team in the league. They're in the middle tier of teams trying to get better. And that's where the Buccaneers are. And that's why you have to compare and contrast the first half to the second half. First half, learn from the mistakes, go to the second half. And that's what this season is going to be about. Because we discussed this last week. Tampa's not going to the playoffs. They're not going to make a miraculous Super Bowl run. None of that is happening. Okay? They still have a year or two of building to do. And they're going to go to the draft this offseason. And they're going to get some more pieces. And they're going to build. And, you know, and again, look at a positive in this. A higher draft choice. Who maybe you can get a top-notch, top-tier defensive back. Linebacker to get in this defense. Maybe not a linebacker, but, you know, I'm thinking of the kid from Notre Dame. The flying Hawaiian running around in the Tampa secondary wouldn't be the worst vision in the world to be seeing. But, you know, getting a top-notch prospect is what I'm saying in this upcoming draft, because that's what we're looking at. The Bucs are going to get a higher draft pick. They're not going to get a winning record, get into the playoffs, but I don't think they're going to be around average. I think it's going to be a 6-10 type season, which is, you know, going to put them in a nice position to build for the future. And that's what's going on right now, building for the future, looking at the pieces, comparing and contrasting. Again, like we said, first half, not so much. Second half, you take a look at guys flying around the field, Lavonte David. You've got Mark Barron flying around. Rondae Barber was hot in the first half. Stayed consistent in the second half. Just kind of making things work before you start connecting things. You've got to get things to work before you connect things. And that's going to be key moving forward. And we saw on Sunday that this team is very much capable of going to the locker room, reevaluating what they did wrong in the first half, moving on to the second half, correcting that, and making it a close football game. And they potentially could have won that game, which would have only reinforced the comparing and contrasting aspect of the game. But all of the winning is for the future. What you have to look at right now is what needs to be built on. Okay? Second half doesn't need to be built on. Focus on that first half. But the key to take out of that is that the Bucs, they know how to correct themselves. And that's really, really, really great. We're kind of blurring the lines here between the good, the bad, and the ugly, I've been noticing. So I don't think it's really going to be defined as segments here. It's just kind of a general recap. But, you know, the good, obviously, Josh Freeman, career day. Vincent Jackson helping Josh Freeman out on that career day. And Doug Martin gets honorable mention for his fantastic day. The bad and the ugly, they're not so much blurred together this week as they were in weeks past. The good and the bad kind of go together because, you know, it's the whole comparing and contrasting thing that we just talked about. But the ugly is very much separate from the good and the bad. And the ugly is not the first half where they allowed 28 points. It's some of the play calling. And this isn't the first time that the play calling has found its way into the ugly part of the analysis. Particularly, I want to take a look at the play that, or the plays, I should say, that followed the 95-yard pass to Vincent Jackson that gave the Buccaneers first and goal at the either the 3-4, somewhere inside of the 5. So you have very, very little yardage to go to tie the game at that point. Okay, so this is huge. This makes it 28-28, and all of a sudden, we have ourselves a tie football game again. And it's, you know, your traditional shootout. But what happens is three consecutive run plays and a pass play that didn't really look like it was going anywhere from the start, when Josh Freeman takes the ball and basically bootlegs it out. I want to focus on the three running plays, though. Because a lot of people were talking to me after the game saying that LeGarrette Blount was set up to fail. And immediately when I hear the word set up, I think conspiracy. And when I think conspiracy, I think crazy people, and I just tune out. But there is some weight to the argument that LeGarrette Blount was set up to fail. And I'm going to be flirting a very dangerous line between conspiracy and truth here, but we're going to give it a shot anyways. Many people know I'm not a conspiracy theorist in the slightest. But we're going to go ahead and tread this line, and we'll see which side of it I end up on. But I'm still trying to figure this out. Why you go three consecutive run plays to a running back that is not consistently good in short yardage situations? You take a look at LeGarrette Blount, what he does, and I get the logic behind it. You need to go short yardage so you get your big burly back in there to, you know, plow through some defenders and get into the goal line. But the footnote on the bottom of that is exactly what we just said. LeGarrette Blount is not a very good short yardage runner. If you're in this situation, a goal line situation, forget that the goal line is there. This is a short yardage situation. Pretend it's for a first down. Pretend it's, you know, first and five or whatever. And you need to get there. Go ahead and put Blount in for one of those runs. That's fine. I don't see anything wrong with putting Blount in for one of those runs. You know, he needs to be utilized at some point in this offense. And I don't think the Bucs are really sure what to do with him. And nothing made that more clear than putting him in three consecutive running plays down inside of the goal line. But you put Blount in for one of those, that's fine. Bring in Doug Martin for one of those. I don't say that because he's on my fantasy football team. But, you know, bring Doug Martin in for, you know, swing it around to one of the sides, try to get him into the corner of the end zone, you know, or even go passing play in that situation. Because you bootleg Josh Freeman out on the fourth down play, that's fine if he has to throw it away on second down. Go ahead, that's fine. If he has a lane to run, that's even better. He takes it, runs, and at the very least gets the ball a little closer to the goal line. And, you know, of course, best case scenario is he finds Dallas Clark or Mike Williams or, you know, Tyquan Underwood in the end zone, and you've got your touchdown right there. So that's probably what should have happened on second down. Don't put Blount in there, especially after he loses yardage on first down. Okay, he's a big boy. He's not going to, you know, go on the sidelines and cry because you took him out of the game because he lost yardage. You lose yardage, it happens. It's not like he's losing carries over lost yardage. He's just losing carries because he's losing carries. Second down, that's what should have happened. Either try the pass play or bring in Doug Martin. And then on third down, I mean, this coaching staff, they get ragers for bringing in DJ Ware on third downs and doing these little dink and dive passes to, you know, whatever, try to make it fourth down to manageable or maybe get a first down. All these third down plays, I mean, DJ Ware comes in, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Why not bring him in a situation that's essentially the same exact situation he's brought in all the time? You've got a third down play, and I understand goal line situations are different, but you got to change it up at some point. I mean, I understand the traditional thing to do is to bang the football in, try to run it, because chances are if you run it three consecutive times, it might work one of those times if you're dealing with a short yardage situation. But if you deal with a back who's not good in short yardage situations, you know, something's not equating right there. The pieces don't mix, you know. You're putting a square block into a circular hole. So the absence of DJ Ware on third down was a little conspicuous to me. I have to preference this by saying I understand the logic, because it's a traditional logic to bring your big back in and try to bang him in. And I guess LeGarrette Blount's been the goal line back. It's never been officially, like, a title handed to him, but goal line situations, we typically see LeGarrette Blount in there. I don't think – I mean, I also this is in hindsight, too, viewing it as a short yardage situation. Because if LeGarrette Blount bangs that thing in on third down, discussion's completely over and everybody says, oh, yeah, LeGarrette Blount, he's fine. He can – the goal line back, short yardage situations, it's not a problem. This is a problem because it didn't work and the Buccaneers go 95 yards in one play and get zilch out of it. So in hindsight – again, all of this. Blount on first down. Great. Doesn't work. All right. Go to a passing play, a bootleg play, or something with Doug Martin on second down. That doesn't work. Bring in DJ Ware. Because then at the very least, you're changing things up for this Saints defense. They're in a goal line stance. Whatever. That's great. It's cute. But this whole coaching regime, this whole play calling regime up to this point has been about changing things up, about going against the grain. And I'm not just talking about play calling in particular. I'm talking about the attitude of this new regime. Because you look at the kneel-down play in New York. You take a look at that ridiculous line shift on the 50-some-yard field goal attempt by Hartley that the Bucs get a personal foul call for drawing the Saints offsides. Those kinds of things where you're going against the grain and doing something different, to then go down and be repetitive in a goal line situation. And the Buccaneers really aren't repetitive in their goal line situations in the past. It was confusing and frustrating and very, very difficult to digest and analyze. But, you know, all of this, again, is in hindsight. But the thing about LeGarrette Blount being set up to fail, I disagree with it, because I don't think any regime, any coach or regime, whatever you want to say, call it, is going to set up a player to fail. LeGarrette Blount, he's been successful in Tampa before. He's an asset on the offense because he's a very much a change of pace back, because he's not LeGarrette, or he's not Doug Martin, and he's not DJ Ware. So he's very much a different kind of back, and he's a tool that can be utilized. I don't see a reason why he would be set up to fail. I do, though, understand why people see it that way. Because he comes in three consecutive plays, and he's not a great short yardage runner. And he's not really been used in this offense the way that he would hope to have been used, or people viewing the games maybe thought that he was going to be used. And I'm going back to the preseason in this one where, you know, Up until the drafting of Doug Martin, LeGarrette Blount is the starter in Tampa. He's the starting running back. He's getting a majority of the carries. And even after Doug Martin gets drafted, it's not until the preseason that we start to see a gray area in between who's the starter, Doug Martin or LeGarrette Blount. And it's not until LeGarrette Blount gets injured in the first preseason game that all of a sudden Doug Martin's the starter. So there has been some confusion about where exactly LeGarrette Blount fits into this offense. So I think that's where people are maybe getting this thing that he's been set up to fail by coming in there. But that idea in of itself is just ridiculously asinine and stupid that you kind of have to, you know, take off the fan cap for a second and be like, okay, yeah, he's not been set up to fail, because why would a team risk points just to send a message to a player? And if they're willing to get rid of this player, why are they making him look so horrible that they cannot maybe get something in return at the trade deadline? You know, why are you trying to hurt his value? The whole notion that he was set up to fail is just ridiculous. But it does bring up a good point that we're 7 weeks into this season. We don't know what LeGarrette Blount is on this team. Is he the backup running back? Is he the goal line running back? Is he a change of pace back? He's not the third down running back. We don't know what LeGarrette Blount is on this team. And that's very absurd that we don't know, given that he's been the starter for, you know, the past two seasons in Tampa. And he's been, you know, very successful at that. You know, he's not, you know, breaking records or anything like that or leading the league, but he's not been a burden out of the backfield. And so now to be 7 weeks into the season and not know what he is on this team, I think that that's a very interesting point raised by the whole debate of was he set up to fail, which I have to roll my eyes at every time I say. But it does bring up a good point, so I do have to credit the people who bring up that aspect of it for inspiring the idea, or kind of playing into the idea that LeGarrette Blount is a man without a purpose on this team. And that's very peculiar and something that we're going to have to watch develop as we continue through this season. Because as of right now, it looks like LeGarrette Blount is a goal line back, which makes sense as to why he was left in the goal line situation. But he's not a good short yardage back, which essentially are kind of goal line situations. It's, you know, it's something that it's very difficult to wrap your head around when it comes to LeGarrette Blount. So that was definitely an ugly, very, very ugly. A lot of people say that the call at the end of the game was ugly, and I do want to address that, but let's just go ahead and say that this 95-yard play that ends in 0 points and the play-calling execution that followed it is without a doubt probably the ugliest sequence of plays that we've seen so far this season, at least from this offense. And we've seen some pretty woeful executions of plays so far with this offense, and I think that goal line stand or that goal line situation and the ensuing stand by the New Orleans Saints definitely qualifies for one of the ugliest, if not the ugliest, sequence of plays that we've seen all season. But to wrap things up here, we're going to address the very end of the game and the quote-unquote controversy that followed. Because at this point, the morning after, I don't think that there's a whole lot of people that are still subscribing to the notion that the Bucks were screwed out of their win. Because first of all, it was going to be a tie. So there's no guarantee that the Buccaneers win the coin toss and Drew Brees doesn't burn them on the first play or something bizarre happens. There's no guarantee that the Buccaneers win that game. Connor Barth could miss the field goal or the extra point. Okay, we saw it at the end of the Jaguars-Saints game so many years ago where we had the miraculous finish by the Saints only to have the extra point missed and the Saints lose by a point after their miraculous finish. No guarantee that the Bucks win that game, but I understand the gripe that fans have with the call, but it was the correct call made, and I want to put the emphasis on correct. It was not a botched call. They didn't make the wrong call. They didn't rush the call. It wasn't a gray area call. It was the right call. And I think that this is a situation where, and I'm the last guy in the world that wants to hate on the replacement officials, but I think this is the type of situation where if the replacement officials were here, I think that gets called a touchdown, to be perfectly honest with you, or at the very least, pass interference. So even though the Buccaneers lose, the integrity of the game was not messed with thanks to the officials, because the correct call was made. The rules state that the player that the ball is being thrown to, so the eligible receiver, if he's shoved out of bounds while the quarterback is in the pocket, then he has the chance to come back and reestablish himself, and if he catches the ball and is the first person to touch the ball, just as long as he's reestablished himself after coming back inbounds, that's fine. Okay? That's not what happened on Sunday. Josh Freeman rolls out, he's out of the pocket, and whether the Saints defenders know this or it was just a bizarre circumstance, Mike Williams ends up in the back of the end zone and out of bounds thanks to a shove. And it was a shove. Some people are saying he walked out or he steps out. He was shoved out. But I think, I'm going to give the Saints defenders the benefit of the doubt here. I think they see Josh Freeman rolls out of the pocket and they push him out of bounds because they know now he can't catch that ball. And all of a sudden, you don't have that target in the back of the end zone. And that's clearly where Josh Freeman's throwing. And if he's going to throw to anybody else, he has to throw across his body and chances are that's not going to work. So it was a, I'm going to give the Saints the benefit of the doubt here and say that was a very strategic move to angle Mike Williams out of bounds. And it's not illegal contact or pass interference because the ball's not in the air, so it's not pass interference right off the bat. Secondly, it's not illegal contact because the quarterback is out of the pocket. if it was illegal contact, the quarterback would have to be in the pocket, and then the whole reestablishing himself in bounds would only be if the flag was not thrown. But because he was outside of the pocket, all of a sudden the rules change, and there can be contact. And it wasn't a aggressive shove. It was not like Mike Williams was picked up by his shoulder pads and body slammed into the ground. It was a shove, but it wasn't anything that we don't usually see when players are going at it in, you know, regular routes. Okay, so it wasn't anything excessive by the Saints. And, you know, to be honest, Mike Williams was treading a very thin line between inbounds and out of bounds. And clearly it did not take much to push him out of bounds. So it wasn't illegal contact because it wasn't anything that was outside of the realm of what usually goes on. So that puts the end to that. And then you have basically the rest of the play and there's no penalty because it doesn't exist. There's no illegal contact. There's no pass interference. Mike Williams clearly was out of bounds and clearly was the first person to touch the ball while Josh Freeman was clearly out of the pocket and threw the ball after Mike Williams had been nudged out of bounds, shoved out of bounds, whatever you want to say it. That's how it happened. And so that's why the penalty was called, and it was correctly called. In the heat of the moment, that's the wrong call to the team that's getting screwed out of the win. Quote-unquote, screwed out of the win. And I was watching it, and I didn't believe it, and I didn't. My reaction was, it can't end like this. And it wasn't because the Bucs got screwed, it wasn't because the wrong call was made, it was just to have the game end like that, after building from the comeback win and the drive, and you know, you didn't think that they were going to be able to go down the length of the field and get into scoring range, and all of a sudden they are, they convert on fourth down, they get all the way up there, and then to have the game end the way that it did with the penalty because Mike Williams touches the ball, you know, he makes himself ineligible. It's just a very, very bizarre way to end the type of game that was had on Sunday. And I think that's where a lot of the animosity towards the call comes from. And it's understandable, too, because if it was on the other side, if you put the shoe on the other foot, and Drew Brees is driving down the field to win the game, and Marquise Colston is pushed out of bounds, and he comes back inbounds and the flag is thrown, all of a sudden, Saints fans are angry. They're saying the refs are homers. They're working with the home crowd. All of this stuff. And then, you know, it turns into a conspiracy against the Saints. So you got to look at it from both sides here. The reason that it's a bad call for Bucs fans is because the Bucs were on the wrong side of that call. And it was a correct call that they were on the wrong side of. So that needed to be addressed. And I think at this point people are letting it sink in that it was the right call. And I don't blame anybody for the heat of the moment being upset about it. I certainly didn't want to stomach it. And I was frantically looking for some kind of loophole that would have... I don't even know what I was looking for at that point because the game was over. Even if we would have found something that said that the refs screwed the Bucs out of a win, they still don't win the game. Go back to the NFC playoff game against the 49ers and the Giants, I think maybe like 10 years ago, where there's the field goal and then it doesn't work out and they have to throw the ball down, and clearly there's a pass interference play and it's clearly blown. The NFL admitted that they blew a call, a pass interference call, that could have decided a game, a playoff game. They ended somebody's season. They admitted that they ended somebody's season, and they didn't change the results. So, I mean, we can look all we want for whatever proof that the refs screwed the Bucs out of the win, but it doesn't change anything. The Bucs are still 2-4, and the Saints are still 2-4, and the NFC South is still looking like a one-team division, and the Bucs are no better or worse for it. I guess really only the thing that you get out of it is peace of mind. But the correct call was made. And that needs to be addressed. Hopefully everybody gets that at that point, but we just wanted to close out talking about the Week 7 loss on probably what's going to be still a much talked about play well into this week. that, well, I guess hopefully it's not talked about too much because it is a short week for the Bucks. They fly up to Minnesota to get the Minnesota Vikings on Thursday night football. So it's a short week for the Bucks. Quick turnaround. But encouraging, although they lost on Sunday. So there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. Josh Freeman, good. Vincent Jackson, good. Doug Martin, good. Some of the ways that the team allowed the Saints into the game, bad. Not necessarily ugly, because it was corrected in the second half. If it would have continued like it did in the first half, where we had 28 points allowed, and then we allowed another 28 points in the second half, that's definitely classified as ugly. But the Buccaneers, they redeem themselves, and they kind of pull it all together and save themselves from an ugly performance by a very strong defensive showing in the second half, allowing just 7 points and none to Drew Brees. So that's the bad, and the ugly is the ugly play calling and the execution after a 95-yard reception by Vincent Jackson takes the Bucks deep inside of the Saints' 10-yard line. I think they're inside of the 5, and they come away with no points because LeGarrette Blount has no chance to get into that end zone. He gets no help, but he was not set up to fail. So let's stop that. And a bonus ugly, I guess, could be the way that... I don't want to say that it's ugly because Bucks fans, I love the way that they were passionate about the end of that game. Even though a lot of people were on the wrong side of judging that call, it was really great to see that kind of passion come up for the Bucks. And kudos, a bonus. Actually, let's make this the bonus good of the week, goes to Bucks fans. Because not only were they passionate on that last call, and they came out, and it was cause for very good discussion, the greatest discussion I've had with Bucks fans since starting to follow them and being paid to basically have discussions. This is the first good discussion that we've had about the Buccaneers. And it came, and it was great to have. It was great to hear. And kudos, more than kudos, to the Bucks fans that showed up at the Ray J today, because it was not a sellout, but it was enough to break that 85% blackout threshold. So the game was on TV locally for the first time since 1983. First time in a long time since the Bucks have been on locally, but it was great. And it wasn't a nationally televised game, and it wasn't because there was a big-time, you know, once-in-a-lifetime opponent like Peyton Manning coming in. Albeit it was a great divisional game, but that goes even more kudos to Bucks fans because they know to show up for great divisional games. The place was rocking. It wasn't half full with Saints fans. There was a ton of Bucks fans there. It was great to see. So kudos to Bucks fans for taking the lead from the rant last week and getting out there, getting loud, proud, and you know, making some noise for the Buccaneers. That was great. Great, great passion. Hopefully that continues on because this team is only going up. Like we said, short week for the Buccaneers, which means short week on the pewter plank. Get the Vikings on Thursday night at 8:20 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll have lead up to that. Actually, we're going to have to cut the week short. Usually we have Tuesday. We're still recapping the game from Sunday and the other action around the NFL. That's not going to be the case because we are going to start on Tuesday prepping for the game on Thursday. So talking all Bucks prep on Tuesday, Wednesday, and of course Thursday because the game is Thursday night. And then we get to, not relax, but we get to kind of shift around a little bit the post-game coverage because the morning after Hill obviously is not going to be on Monday. It's going to be on Friday morning following what we hope is going to be a Bucks win in Minneapolis against the Minnesota Vikings. And then, of course, we're going to have you covered for the action on Sunday. So it's a different Sunday at the Pewter Plank next week, because on the Bucks bye week, we kind of went around with some general NFL action, and on this Sunday as well, this upcoming Sunday, we'll have general NFL action, because the Bucks won't be in action. They'll have a nice long week after their Thursday game in what I think is the loudest stadium in the NFL. They're going to have some rest time after that, but the Pewter Plank won't rest. We're going to be continuing to give you the best NFL action out there. 35-28, the Buccaneers lose. We went through the good, the bad, and the ugly. Game balls will be on the site. Actually, they should be on the site. Most of you are listening to this. You can go ahead and check them out. Of course, we've already announced that. Josh Freeman, You can't not give him the first game ball of the game. 420 yards, career day, 3 touchdowns, no interceptions. Great, great day by Josh Freeman. But the other 2 game balls, we're not going to tell you about those. Go over and read that right after you finish listening to this. So, good, the bad, and the ugly. This has been the Morning After Hill. Make sure you stick to the Pewter Plank all week long for the best Bucks action out there. I am Josh Hill, editor at the Pewter Plank. We will see you on Thursday for the Buccaneers and the Minnesota Vikings. This has been the Morning After Hill on the PewterPlank.com and PewterPlank Radio Network.